Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rum and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Art Sear of Carthage College and Khalil Marar from DePaul University. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, it's btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. And tonight, for the next couple of hours, we're going to be talking about primarily foreign policy. We'll get into a little bit of domestic policy in hour number two. But primarily, this is a discussion to look at the United States and in the world. And we do that in the wake of President Obama's trip to Israel this past week. Historic in that it is his first visit there since becoming president of the United States. And again, there was some concern about that trip because of the relationship between Netanyahu and President Obama. And yet it looks at the end of the week that maybe that relationship was a lot rosier than it was when the trip began. We have two guests this evening. They're both college professors. They're both knee-deep in the study and the sharing their thoughts and opinions on history, but I'm sure they let their opinions get in there as well with their students. And we're going to begin and give you an opportunity to delve deep into the Middle East and foreign policy and the U.S. role all over the world. Khalil Marar joins us. Khalil, nice. Thank you very much for being with us. You are a Palestinian, but you're a Palestinian-American, and this is one of your areas of expertise in the Middle East. What headline would you put on President Obama's trip?
I would say Obama and Netanyahu are much friendlier. That's the headline that I would give it.
And Art Sear joins us from Carthage College. What headline would you put on that trip?
I like that headline. Also, the two presidents make up, president and prime minister make up, make peace, make a rapport.
How do you judge the authenticity of what you saw this past week? Was it real or was it photo ops? Was it?
I think it was a combination of the two. In terms of national interest, they need each other. In terms of their domestic constituencies, they need each other. Temperamentally, I think they're more separated than they are in policy. But Netanyahu, when he came to Washington last year, had a wonderful verbal bear hug. You are we and we are you. I paraphrase accurately.
As a Palestinian, are you concerned about what came out of that visit last week? What signal was being received by the Palestinian Authority?
Yeah. You know, Palestinians have always tried to be optimistic. And I, for one, I think that, you know, despite all of the negative headlines that are coming out in the Arab press and the Middle East press, I think actually a lot got accomplished. If nothing else, President Obama has basically laid the groundwork for a desire for a two-state solution. This has been a long-established American policy since at least the Bush administration, but also Carter, Clinton, and George H.W. Bush had visions of a two-state solution, not to mention George W. Bush, who actually articulated a two-state solution. So the Palestinians, you know, are basically looking at Obama and saying, well, he's an American president, and he's behaving like an American president, affirming his relationship with Israel, denouncing Israel's enemies, denouncing Israel's enemies as, frankly, America's enemies. But at the same time, a lot of good things got accomplished. So, for example, you had Turkey and Israel engaging in rapprochement, as well as President Obama demonstrating not only the need but the necessity as well as the desire of the United States.
And the background, again, for those that may not be familiar with what caused the rift between Turkey and Israel, explain that and explain the importance of what a basic phone call that President Obama really engineered.
Absolutely. It was when Israeli commandos stormed a Turkish ship, a Turkish national ship that was bound for Gaza to offer aid, and killed a bunch of people, including Turkish civilians. That was where the cool down of relations took place. President Obama has essentially single-handedly brought Turkey and Israel back together not on any sort of table, but really on the table of repentance for Israel, on a table of rapprochement for Turkey and Israel.
Now, last year, Prime Minister Netanyahu was really talking a great deal about, you know, the timeline. When he appeared before the United Nations, he showed the red line and the timeline of when action had to be taken against Iran to keep them from being able to create a nuclear weapon. He talked about the spring of this year. Well, we're basically in the spring now. But yet the signal and the rhetoric, at least that has been reported out of this trip, suggests that maybe that fine line in the sand that was being drawn last fall is no longer applicable.
I think that's right. Both leaders have to speak to their domestic constituencies, especially Netanyahu. So it's not surprising when he's talking, especially in an election period, to his home audience, he's a lot more hard line than otherwise. Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the UN, talked last month with great optimism about the six countries, including the U.S., involved in direct negotiations with Iran. I think there are grounds for hope. There is no hard evidence, I repeat, no hard evidence beyond the blustering rhetoric on both sides that Iran is actually constructing nuclear weapons. Now, I don't want to wait till it's too late, but it's important to look at what countries are actually doing. That's one thing we should have learned from our invasion and occupation of Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Do you believe that that war, let's now switch to a different subject, and that is Syria. The United States' role in Syria today, is it respected around the world, or is it viewed as weakness?
You know, that's a great question. Most of the world's population does not really perceive the United States acting in Syria. That is not to say that they perceive us as being weak. It is to say, however, that they view us as being indifferent to the plight of the now 80,000 Syrians that have died as a result of Assad's onslaught against his population. That is not to say that the United States of America has been sitting by idly. I mean, if you look at the participants on the ground, Bruce, you will see that Qatar, for example, a major U.S. ally, you will see that Saudi Arabia, as well as Turkey, have all engaged in trying to not topple the Assad regime, but definitely arm the resistance. And as a result of that arming of the resistance, you essentially have an intensification of an otherwise low-intensity civil war or low-intensity conflict. In other words, what the American role has been is not only to arm the, you know, Syrian opposition, but it's also been to arm them through proxy. And as a result, you have not only an intensification of the civil war, but you have a prolonging of the inevitable, mainly a toppling of the Assad regime.
Should the United States be more aggressive in providing maybe its own military support, which is what Secretary of State Clinton and former head of the CIA, Leon Panetta, were suggesting to the president, ideas that he has rejected, Art?
No, we shouldn't. Those were news reports, and they may be reliable, but no senior official of the U.S. government on the record advocated aiding them. I think Khalil is quite right to emphasize the important role of other nations in the region, especially Turkey. I'm glad he knows so much about the subject. I think any direct military intervention could be very counterproductive and probably would be, and I'm very glad that we are strategically lowering our profile and withdrawing, especially from our land involvement militarily in the Middle East and South Asia generally.
We're going to pause. 1-800-723-8229, getting your thoughts and opinions on the president's trip to Israel last week, your reaction, how you read the trip, and also any additional questions you have about that region. Also, I know a pet topic to a lot of people is U.S. foreign aid, and we're going to talk about that before the hour ends tonight. Back shortly. From Columbus, Ohio to Spokane, Washington, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8229. Talking about foreign policy in our broadcast this evening. Let's head to Eddie listening to us in Chicago on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead, Eddie. You're on the air.
Yeah, Bruce. How you doing? Okay. Yeah, I don't think we should be training Syrian rebels because I think it's going to be like the 1980s Mujahideen. I mean, we're giving like $500 million to Palestinians, too. I mean, money should be spent wisely or in something better.
Such as? What would you, it was specifically within Syria?
Well, no, I'm becoming more of an isolationist. I mean, we got problems domestically. I want to close bases all around the world, so, yeah.
Eddie, stay on the line because I want to let our guests just sort of respond to that because your point of view is not it's not unique. You're not the only one with that, but you had the guts to call in. And let's talk about the how interventionist the United States should be. Obviously, we have a president that seems to sort of back away from that, other than previous administrations. Could we look forward to the next 20 years where the United States doesn't want to get involved anywhere, Art? And is that a wise policy?
No, I think it would be unwise for us to try to be uninvolved everywhere. It would be impossible. The president, in fairness to Obama and the subject, he did decide after some long consideration to increase our involvement in Afghanistan. And now, of course, we're withdrawing, but this has not been a president who simply wanted to withdraw from everywhere. He did make a campaign promise the first time around to withdraw from Iraq, and we have in terms of direct ground combat involvement. But no, I don't think we can or should withdraw from the world, and I'm very glad that I'm in line with the majority of the American people.
Khalil?
On a sustained basis.
What do you think?
I think it would be a disaster for the United States to turn isolationist. And with all due respect to Eddie, I completely understand where he's coming from. And on most days, I think that we should really focus on nation building here at home. But at the same time, we have a foreign policy where we must actually engage with the rest of the world. We've seen when the United States turns isolationist, whether it's World War I or the malaise or whatever you want to call it, that we have had all kinds of negative consequences befall us. I don't think that staying out of international events is an option, especially considering that the Assad regime will get support from all kinds of opposition to the United States geostrategically, geopolitically. So, for example, if the United States backs away from not necessarily supporting the rebels, but really not caring, if it doesn't care about what happens in Syria, we're going to have a situation where the Russians and the Chinese are engaging with the Assad regime to our detriment in the region and elsewhere.
Well, last week the president said that he wants Congress to send an additional $200 million to aid mm-hmm. the Syrian rebels.
That's
not
right.
Necessarily arm them, but aid them. I don't know exactly what that means.
That's right.
What does that mean? Where does that $200 million go?
Yeah.
And how can the U.S. taxpayer feel comfortable that it's being used wisely, just like $200 million spent on anything else the government does?
Yeah, and that's a great point. I must distinguish between aid for Syrian refugees that's going to Jordan, for example, that President Obama has pledged yesterday in his visit to Jordan, and aid going to the Syrian rebels. A lot of that aid, it's a tripartite or a trifecta, whatever you want to call it. A lot of that aid goes towards basically dealing with the humanitarian catastrophe that's befalling the Syrian people. So think here about, for example, tents and cold weather. Think about medical aid and so on and so forth. A portion of that, let's be honest here, goes towards arming the Syrian rebels. Now, the question is, by my count, there's about 17 different factions that are operating within Syria at the present time. And as Eddie points out, the Mujahideen issue should not be lost on us. About 40% of those elements are actually considered to be Islamists in some way, shape, or form. So we have to be careful about our priorities and who we're arming, who we're engaging.
Eddie, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm still here.
All right, I want to ask this question. It's just been explained that at least in this particular instance, because, again, when you talk about foreign aid, it's a huge subject. So I'm trying to zero in on what the president talked about last week. $200 million to deal with humanitarian ramifications of what's happening in Syria. As an American, how do you feel about the role of America in the world to help those who cannot help themselves?
Yeah, I mean, building schools, getting people trained to be better people, better citizens in their country, I'm for that. But somehow the money will get siphoned off to
TV. Or giving them basic things like food and medicine.
Right, food and medicine, right.
Right.
I mean, I think more of the military should be, as far as our American forces, I'm more of an idea of having them guard the Mexican-U.S. border.
Okay, so that's another way to use the military. But again, I'm talking about the use of the dollars. And Art, I want to sort of expand that conversation to you, because when we do things like that, and again, how do we compare with the other wealthy nations of the world. If the United States is giving $200 million to this effort, in a humanitarian effort, mm-hmm. to help those that are fleeing Syria and going elsewhere, and they're not living in tents, they're out there wandering on the desert somewhere. Are there other leading nations of the world, the wealthy nations of the world? What are they giving? Are they giving $200 million? Are they giving nothing? Or are they just wringing their hands and say, boy, it's a terrible thing. We're going to let the Americans pay the bill.
Other wealthy nations generally give a larger percentage and a larger amount of money in direct bilateral assistance than we give. I'm not saying that's good or bad. Foreign aid historically has been extraordinarily controversial in this country. Keep in mind private philanthropy, which is an Anglo-American, Anglo-Saxon tradition. We give a phenomenal amount. It's growing rapidly, and it has nothing to do with tax laws or anything else. So when you factor in private and personal philanthropy, why, we are pretty much a leader in the world. And that's an important point to make, because conservatives are so hard on foreign aid, and some people on the left are so hard on Americans.
But again, when you talk about the other nations, that you say a higher percentage. I mean, is it? I don't quite understand what you're saying. In other words, the Germans, the British, the French, the Saudis, the wealthy nations of the world, are they? How much money are they putting in
of their GDP? By the way,
I don't know in detail, but generally, historically, we've given a smaller percentage of both our national budget mm-hmm. and our GDP mm-hmm. in bilateral aid.
Smaller percentage, but a larger amount.
Larger amount, yeah. We're big in other areas as well. We're by far the biggest military arms supplier in the
world.
Are
we doing that?
That involves aid as well as sales. We give away far more weaponry than anybody else.
Are we doing that in your mind? Are we doing that because we as Americans care more about people than anybody else in the world?
No.
Or are we doing this because we think we can buy some friends?
Well, we're let me emphasize, and this really speaks to private philanthropy. The American people, we're the most generous people on earth. I firmly believe that, and I will go to my grave believing that, not because I believe in America, but because we have the numbers. We have the data to back this up, right? And the fact is that Americans do give an awful lot. Now, the question is, what is it directed towards, especially when it comes to government-to-government aid? I remember a mentor of mine, Jamal Nassar, constantly said that we give to the greedy, not the needy. And I think that when you look at our priorities in terms of to whom we give aid to, we're not necessarily giving aid to, say, poor countries in Asia, Africa, or Latin America. We're giving it really to friends who are doing our bidding, or whom we see as people that are doing our bidding. So our aid doesn't necessarily go all that much towards humanitarian things like, you know, food, water, shelter, housing, and so on and so forth.
In the case of a natural disaster, it might.
It might, absolutely. When we have those grand
tsunamis,
natural disasters,
right.
Tsunamis, earthquakes, and so on and so forth. Yes, the American people is incredibly generous, not just through private philanthropy, but also through our government. But when you look at the mundane, the everyday, American dollars are not going to, you know, so say help out other people. They're really going out to help out the United States by helping out our friends, the people that we perceive to be our friends, or people that have powerful constituencies here in the United States of America. That point must be emphasized anytime we're talking about foreign aid.
Okay. So go ahead, Art.
And most of the USAID budget, it's not us giving dollars directed to countries overseas. As usual, it's more complicated. The vast majority of vendors are American firms.
That's right.
The vast majority of foreign aid goes to American providers.
Given what...
And that's not bad, but it's something to keep in mind, because we tend to feel like a victim.
And it's a form of stimulus, too, by the way. I mean, it helps out American firms, right? We get to sell our goods abroad as a direct result, as a direct consequence of our aid. A lot of it is spent here.
Most people know, I think, that Israel is the largest recipient of foreign aid. In fact, you've written a book on it, the Arab Lobby, U.S. Foreign Policy. We'll talk about that as the
Correct.
Program unfolds this evening.
Right.
But the second biggest recipient is Egypt.
Egypt. Mm-hmm.
What have we gotten out of that relationship with Egypt?
We've gotten peace with Israel.
So that's the price of it.
Absolutely. That we bought the peace with Israel.
So without that price, there would be no peace. There wouldn't be a peace between those two. The big deal between Israel and Egypt was about money.
It
was a long-term fundraising on the part of Sadat.
When President Carter and Henry Kissinger engaged the Egyptians and the Israelis, those are the price tags that they saw, and that was effectively what we had to pay in order to securitize the region or to securitize Egypt's southern frontier.
So Egypt for a while is the best friend money can buy. Is that what our relationships around the world are all about?
In some ways, Pakistan is also another great friend that money can buy. Israel is another great friend that money can buy. So yes, the Egyptian military, especially because a lot of these are military to military aid, has been one of the best friends that money can buy. And you know, especially under Mubarak, we had an Egypt that was really a bastion of stability in the region. Now the people beg to differ, and as a result, they overthrow their leader. But even with the Muslim Brotherhood, we still have peace between Egypt and Israel as a result, direct consequence of American engagement.
I want to come back and talk more about that. 1-800-723-8029, foreign policy, foreign aid. We're talking about it tonight. Your reaction, 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont. Back in Chicago, thank you very much for joining us tonight. Khalil Morar is here. He is author of the book, The Arab Lobby, U.S. and Foreign Policy. He is an assistant professor at a variety of areas, universities and colleges in the area, and most recently at DePaul University. And also, we did something a couple of weeks ago when one of your colleagues was here. I went online and I read the Rate Your Professor.
Oh.
And here's what they said about you. Dr. Morar is brilliantly intelligent. He is also a kind and thoughtful person, the best professor I ever had. Intelligent professor, you'll learn plenty in his class. He encourages a lot of classroom activity. And it's pretty mandatory to come to class if you want to get a good grade. That's good. I like that. I'm sure every parent will like that. The students actually have to come to class to get a grade. You know, some professors don't care that. And then, obviously, it says you're one of the nicest people they've ever had. His lectures can be a bit confusing, but he is funny and will help his students no matter what time of the day. So nice little reviews.
My students are my best fans. I love them.
Well, that's good, obviously. Great reviews. And Art Sear also joins us. He is the A.W. Clawson Professor at Carthage College. We're going to read your reviews sometime in the future. I don't have yours tonight. Many years at the Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. But also we should mention that for many years he was the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations and a graduate of UCLA and from Hollywood High, right?
Right.
Beautiful Hollywood High. Let's go back to calls. Let's go to Fred listening to us on WoWo in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Nice to hear from Indiana tonight.
Yes, sir.
You guys hung on.
But your landline there. I can barely hear you.
You guys hung on to win that basketball game.
In any case, let me keep on here. The last comment I heard your guest make was that the U.S. should continue to send weapons to Israel because the Muslim Brotherhood has the same stability factor that the Mubarak regime did. So let me ask him this counter question. Are they expecting an invasion from Libya, Sudan, the Arab Emirates? I don't think Russia would come directly at them, but maybe you could elucidate and edify me on just what the import of your message has to do with that, because it makes no sense to me.
Why we continue to add a lot of military might there? Go ahead. Good question.
The question, if the question is why do we continue to add military might to Israel, I completely agree that Israel is secure against all of its neighbors.
No, he was talking about Egypt.
Now, as far as Egypt is concerned, the reason that we arm the Egyptian government, whether it's Mubarak or the Muslim Brotherhood, is for internal stability. I don't like that kind of armament, and I actually agree with the caller quite a bit. And so far as, you know, the Egyptians, if you look at the average Egyptian, they're not only living well, they're living very miserably and wretchedly. I mean, you literally have people in Egypt that sleep to this day. I mean, this used to be the case in the 1970s, 1960s, but that sleep on graves, like in grave areas, right? You have ordinary Egyptians that are struggling. They're poor. They're wretched. They're not very happy. Now, don't get me wrong. There's a lot of Egyptians that are living well, and the majority of the 80 million Egyptians actually love their country and love their land and love their soil and so on and so forth. But the United States is basically arming the Egyptian military to keep internal stability. The same thing that we were doing under Mubarak is what we're doing now, except Mubarak has gone from the scene, and now we have the Muslim Brotherhood cracking
down. But doesn't everybody do that? Isn't that what Musharraf did
Musharraf
in Pakistan?
Did. Absolutely. That's what those dictators are doing in their countries. And we have to ask ourselves as Americans whether that should be a value of ours. It's definitely not a value. Is it in the strategic interest of the United States of America to have so many people around the world hating us because we're arming those dictators and military regimes?
Art, what's your reaction?
Well, there are a lot fewer dictators than there used to be, and I think Americans should be happy about the fact that the spirit of democracy and representative government, along with turmoil, is growing there. I'm very glad Khalil mentioned Kissinger and Carter. Kissinger, who was National Security Advisor and Secretary of State for Nixon and Ford, helped do the groundwork for the Camp David Agreement that Carter achieved. Tremendous, disciplined, long-term effort, something that successful politicians don't normally have the time or temperament to engage in, was essential to that treaty. But the treaty is held, as Khalil points out.
Fred, are you still there?
Well, I can just barely make out what you were saying. I thought I got the gist of it, but I mean, has Egypt really expended any armaments? That they've lost planes and tanks because their troops can't manage to fly them or drive them. I don't quite follow the internal security.
I hope you can hear me now, sir. As Bruce was pointing out, it was the price of the treaty,
right.
And we can be cynical about this, but that peace agreement between Egypt and Israel has been crucial to forestalling another terrible war in the region. I hope you heard that. Let me add, if you can still hear me, that the 1956 Suez Crisis was by far the most serious and destructive crisis in terms of our national interest. Eisenhower, with his usual skill, handled it well, but it underscored the vital importance of Egypt.
Stop for just a second. For those younger listeners to the show, give us a little insight into the Suez Crisis that you just talked about.
Okay.
What was so monumental about that, and how did Eisenhower solve things?
In a nutshell, Britain, France, and Israel, operating quite secretly and with a kind of death wish diplomatically because they did not consult Washington, launched a paratrooper attack on the Suez Canal to retake it. Nasser and the Egyptian nationalists had taken it over from the British company had managed it at the same time that Israeli armor moved into the Sinai Peninsula. Eisenhower operated quickly and decisively to tell these countries, you have to back off. We wound up voting with the Soviet Union in the United Nations. It was the most serious threat to NATO. Governments fell in Britain and France. And the most serious threat to our relationship with Israel, the government in Israel, fell. It shows just how important strategically Egypt was. Thanks to Eisenhower's wisdom and toughness, there's been no effort to return to this kind of imperialistic 19th century gunboat diplomacy since.
I want to go back to my opening question, and that is how the Palestinians and then the Palestinian leaders and supporters around the world, how they're viewing this trip of the president. What are they saying in the Arab and the Palestinian press around the world?
Yeah, so I've been looking at the Palestinian press. I've been looking at Al Jazeera, which is a good sounding board for a lot of the populations that we're looking at. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people are not happy about the American role in the region. A lot of people do not like the fact that President Obama has basically conceded the settlements to Israel and basically has asked the Palestinians to negotiate with the Israelis essentially without having any settlement freeze. And that's a thing that the Palestinians have been wanting since the 1990s. That's a thing that's kept stifling peace relations between the Palestinians and the Israelis. And let me be honest here. I mean, it's not like the Palestinians are in a major position to negotiate with the Israelis. It's more like the ball is in Israel's corner, and so far as the Palestinian Authority is incredibly weak. You have Hamas in Gaza, who's capable of mustering those trash can rockets against Israeli cities, and you basically have the humiliation over and over and over and over of the moderate Palestinian factions that exist in the West Bank because they produce nothing, whereas the people in Gaza, the Hamas in Gaza, is able to produce ceasefires. The Palestinian Authority in the West Bank has done nothing. They have failed miserably in bringing about any peace negotiation, let alone the end to corruption, let alone, I mean, the economy is good there, but you know what? The economy would be good under any leadership, given the facts on the ground.
Art, you agree with that?
Overall, it's been a frustrating situation.
It has.
I don't see how a strong Palestinian Authority can be established when we have had success in the region as a result of Eisenhower, Jimmy Carter, also George Herbert Walker Bush,
yes,
and James Baker. Khalil mentioned them, and that should be underscored. It's been the result of sustained U.S. involvement and pressure. And we haven't had an elected politician since Bush the father, who's been able to achieve that. Clinton, more characteristic of an elected big-time politician. He went to the Middle East. He was hoping to get a peace agreement as one of his last acts. Of course, it didn't work. There was no groundwork done.
Yeah. And let me go back to your excellent question, Bruce. The people in the region mistrust fundamentally American ambitions and intentions in the region. And the truth is, we have basically affirmed that mistrust at every single turn with the latest action that the United States has taken, and that is that we basically have backed off the settlement issue. So President Obama starts out by talking about Israel going back to the June 4th, 1967 boundaries. That's now gone. President Obama talked about the settlements creating misery for the Palestinians. That's no longer on the table. So the question is, what are the Palestinians really getting by negotiations? And the answer is, not a whole lot. Forget about the two-state solution for just a moment and think about what kind of a solution would take place if the Israelis and the Palestinians do not work out their differences along a two-state solution line, and the answer is very dangerous for both sides.
Do we have a situation here, Art, though, whether we're talking about Israel or we're talking about the Palestinian Authority? We have two diametrically opposed forms of government and people and politicians. And those politicians on both sides of this divide, they both know they need the other guy to be the bad guy, to be the boogeyman. Mm. And really, in their heart, there isn't a politician walking the streets of anywhere in that region that really wants peace, because at the moment, they have each other. They have each other to hate. They have each other to point fingers at. They have each other to blame. And so if politicians have a scapegoat, they have collective scapegoats. And so what is the real incentive for any politician on either side of this divide to want real peace?
A lack of popular support for trying to destroy the other side. Not only Egypt, but Jordan and Turkey, each in different ways, has made accommodation with Israel, which is why I'm so glad Khalil mentioned Netanyahu calling his counterpart in Turkey. That's extremely important, especially with a fundamentalist regime in Turkey. As for Israel,
at the urging of President Obama.
Yeah.
On the way up, on his way getting on the plane.
Yeah, and it worked.
Yeah, it did.
Turkey is our only other ally in the region. They're crucial to stability in the area. As for Israel, demographics are against them. Their opinion is divided. They're paying the price of being a heavily armed, very small state. I can't believe, and in fact, there is opinion poll evidence to support this, that young Israelis are nearly as militant as the older people. Younger people who want to get a graduate degree, go to clubs at night, make some money, be a success as a doctor or lawyer, putting on body armor, going out in the occupied territories and shoving around Arabs, that is increasingly unpopular among the younger Israelis.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8289. When we come back, more calls. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's head back to calls. Let's go to Mike listening to us on KXLY in Spokane, Washington. And Mike, first of all, let me offer my condolences on the big upset loss in the NCAA tournament for Gonzaga.
Yeah, thanks, Bruce. We're proud of our team. We're proud of Gonzaga, and good luck to Illinois and Michigan State, and congratulations to Wichita as well, Wichita State. But we'll be back. It's only round three.
Back. You're there. You're there every year. You're like Duke. In every year, you're there. You're there.
What's up, Bruce? And God bless. And happy Palm Sunday and happy Easter. Hungry people do desperate things, and we can never become isolationists or appear to be isolationists. Sometimes weakness leads to confrontations. Those in communist China, some of the leaders, North Korea, and other countries want to confront. And apparent weakness could give them more policy, more strength, that America does nothing. So we got to keep the door open and let them know the door can be closed. Humanitarian aid definitely, including food to Syria, North Korea, other countries. And, of course, the key is trying to make sure the money does not end up in someone's pockets, and that's hard to do.
Mike, let me ask you a question, then I want to get our professors to respond to it.
Sure.
I want to ask you first. Of all the potential trouble spots in the world or unfriendly nations in the world, what is the one that you personally are most concerned about?
Communist China.
Hmm. Okay, why?
Why? Well, because they expand, they continue to expand their military, their occupation of Tibet, their military strength is going, they continue to confront the Philippine Navy, the South China Sea. They continue to expand worldwide. Their cyberspace activities, alleged, but I believe correctly so. Mm-hmm. If there's no, if they appear to be a weakness, they will continue to expand this policy.
Okay. Mike, stay on the line. I want to get our professors to respond to that. Arts, let me ask you, just to respond to Mike's question, mm-hmm. where would you put China on a list of nations that trouble you at the moment?
Not that high. China's engaging in a substantial arms buildup, but historically China has been very cautious about using force overseas, historically and currently. In some ways they're like Russia, in great contrast to Germany and Japan.
But the cyber attack, should we take them seriously?
I don't think we're allies. I don't think we're friends. But sure, we should take any attack of that sort seriously. The military tends to go its own way in that country and in other countries.
Bill, where would you put China on the list of troubled nations for you?
Well, you know, I would put them at number one. And the reason for that is not so much China. Art is very correct to point out that the Chinese have been very wise and have been very cautious in their dealings around their region and around the world, ultimately. But at the same time, if you look at, for example, you know, Africa, if you look at what's taking place in Africa, it really is a renaissance where you have Chinese manpower and Chinese infrastructure being built from the ground up, where Africa now is beginning to turn towards Beijing and not Washington, is really not a frightening prospect. I mean, it's good that somebody is finally coming through for, you know, African nations, but at the same time, the Chinese do not have the concern that we have as the American people with Republican forms of government or democracy or something like that. And it scares me that because the Chinese are sort of political agnostics that way, they don't really care about whether somebody's a dictator or not. They'll help out in whatever way is necessary so that they can improve their interests. They're kind of cutting in on our action in places like Africa, elsewhere in Asia, and elsewhere in Latin America.
Art, if China is not a grave concern to you, mm-hmm. what nation would you put at the top of your list as the most feared rogue nation that's out there at the moment?
Mm. Most dangerous currently, I think, is North Korea. Mm-hmm. The Korean War was an extraordinarily costly war. It made the Cold War global. President Eisenhower had to engage in unusually brutal means to bring about the armistice. The armistice has still lasted, but they're the one regime left in the world, especially now that Burma is opening up, that is truly totalitarian. This kind of collective insanity that defined these 20th century dictatorships, you still find it in North Korea.
Khalil?
I would agree with my colleague, Dr. Sear. And the truth is, yes, North Korea is also an equal threat to American interests. But at the same time, you know, I don't think anybody at this table or elsewhere would disagree that without China, North Korea would not be engaged in the kind of dangerous diplomacy that it's engaged in. I mean, China has numerously or a number of occasions blocked all kinds of sanctions condemning North Korea. Now, the latest round, you know, this missile launch and stuff like that, China has actually, you know, begrudgingly gone with. But at the same time, North Korea would not be getting away with the stuff that it's getting away with without its big brother, China. And that's something that we have to confront as Americans
but
and
again,
as global citizens.
Does the new leader of North Korea, does he know that he's got to continue to keep at least relations with China? Or is he such a nutcase, let me be blunt here,
yeah.
is he such a nutcase that he doesn't think he even has to worry about what China thinks?
You know, I'll defer to Art on this answer, but my answer, you know, and this is something that I've thought about quite a bit, is that the new leader is actually following in the footsteps of his father. I think he's very rational, and I think he does respond to a carrot-and-stick approach, and we have seen responses. And yet at the same time, because he sees that he has nothing to lose, and because he sees Chinese support in terms of what he has to gain, I think he's acting in ways that might be construed as irrational, even though I think the North Koreans are playing an end game that is fairly rational under this new leader.
What do you think, Art?
We really don't know.
Is he crazy or crazy like a fox?
I don't know, and we don't know how much power he has. He's very young.
Yeah.
He's very sheltered. I don't want to be
likes
too
Dennis
glib.
Rodman.
It's very easy to be glib. And,
Ambassador Dennis Rodman.
Yeah. I think that shows an insular nature to the regime.
Yeah.
And an insular nature to that fool Dennis Rodman. Kim Il-sung, the spiritual son of his grandfather, of Stalin. I mean, he was very much in charge. Kim Jong-il, it seemed like the army and other interest groups were more free. This guy, whether he's a figurehead, he's still in his 20s. Oh. And he seems, in his public statements, discounting for ideological excesses, which they've always engaged in, he seems really goofy. He really seems more bizarre than the others. Nobody would call Stalin or Kim Il-sung bizarre.
But somebody likely we're going to be dealing with for 50 years.
Right.
For 50 years,
right.
At least.
I think they may
years.
Collapse. They may collapse.
On that note, we're going to pause. For those listening to us on radio, we're going to be back with another full hour. We're going to continue our discussion about foreign policy, but also talk about some domestic issues as well. And also, if you're watching us on television, we'll see you next week. From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Art Sear of Carthage College and Khalil Marar, author of the book, The Arab Lobby, U.S. and Foreign Policy. And we thank you very much for joining us tonight. Phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289. We've been talking in hour number one about the president's recent trip to Israel. If you'd like to talk about that, feel free to do so. But again, we have two experts in the area of foreign policy, and we're sort of expanding our base tonight and talking about foreign policy, U.S. roles around the United States and around the world, I should say. And I want to, in this segment of the program, next couple of segments, and let people weigh in as well, I'd like you to kind of look into the crystal ball and tell us what you see specifically as it relates to Syria. We talked about some of the options in hour number one, but Khalil, where do you see things evolving? Give us your end game scenario in Syria for the United States and the rest of the world.
Yeah. We're on the record right now and speaking to folks across the nation. I would say that Assad will be gone. It's not a matter of whether he will be gone. It's a matter of when. By my estimation and by my analysis of force on the ground, both from the insurgents as well as the Assad regime, I think that the guy will be gone come July 4th. But it takes that one major incident to take place, and that is that a major power has to align itself with the Syrian opposition and do so overtly, using NATO perhaps, or using the military might of Western Europe and the United States of America. Short of that, Assad has some staying power, but he will be gone if there is intervention from the major powers.
Art, do you agree with that? And if so, what nation might step up to be that military might?
Well, I certainly defer to Khalil's expertise. I certainly don't presume to know exactly when or even if he'll go down. They're not a major oil producer, or even a minor one, so the incentive that NATO, specifically the Italians and the French, had to remove Gaddafi and company in Libya isn't there. I believe Russia and China have been giving him assistance. We did intervene, I'm sure, with Israeli close cooperation to destroy a nuclear facility that the North Koreans, we were discussing them last hour, helped him build. So they are increasingly isolated. And Khalil's absolutely right. In regional context, these different countries that have no democratic tradition or heritage in most cases are moving toward representative government.
Iran, I'm going to let you start that, Art. What's the future of Iran, and what is the future of is war, in your view, inevitable with Iran?
No, I don't think it's inevitable. I think it would be a terrible disaster. The currency of the country effectively collapsed about a month ago, which shows that these sanctions, which are comprehensively in place, even Russia has joined the frontline states, the six countries, including the U.S., negotiating with Iran. There is no hard evidence. It's important to underscore this. There's no hard evidence that they're actually constructing nuclear weapons. And given the heat of the rhetoric, especially emanating from Israel, but also from Capitol Hill, it's important to keep that in mind.
Khalil, where do you see the Iranian-U.S. collision course?
Well, you know, I don't think that – I think that this president is as tough as any of the previous presidents on Iran. And as President Obama has pointed out over and over and over and over again, we have had engaged in some of the most, and I quote, crippling sanctions against the country ever. And as my colleague points out very clearly and very eloquently, the Iranian currency has collapsed last year. The question is not so much whether we can, you know, engage Iran militarily as much as to what extent we can contain it. And I think the containment policy is working. The Iranians are looking for a way out, and we have to allow them for a way out, that way out. And that way out is really three things. The first is Iran wants non-aggression from its neighbors, mainly Israel and the regional partner that the Israel has, mainly the United States of America. Iran wants a cheap source of fuel, and Iran wants to be brought back into the community of nations. You know, we have not had relations with this country since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. I think it's high time that we actually incorporate them into the community of nations, so long as they pledge and so long as we can verify that they are working constructively, not so much in favor of America, but really ultimately in favor of Iran. Iran wants stability in the region.
Going back to something that we discussed in hour number one, when a leader of another nation, an anti-Israel nation, says Israel doesn't have a right to exist, and whether it's Ahmadinejad or other leaders, I mean, he's not the only one to have spoken those words. Should we as Americans say, well, you know, that's just political rhetoric, or that he really believes that, or he's just doing it for domestic politics? How real are those words, and are they really playing to a constituency in his nation, and are they playing to a broad constituency in his nation? Art.
Yes, they're playing to a broad constituency in his nation, and yes, we should take them very seriously. What it brings attention back to what's more important, which is what nations actually do. In the case of both Iraq, with the exception of Kuwait, in support of terrorism against Israel, and in the case of Iran, with the exception of terrorism against Israel, there hasn't been a region-wide war in the Middle East, I don't believe, since the early 80s, when I think the Israeli invasion of Lebanon counts as a regional war, but even if you discount that, you have to go back to the 1970s. We have, in that sense, had an absence of general regional warfare in the region. I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna, but that's a plus. These countries generally have a disconnect between substantial aggressive military behavior on the one hand and their apocalyptic, hate-filled rhetoric on the other.
In the last hour, you said that you thought that North Korea was on the top of your list of the most feared or concerned,
most dangerous
nation on Earth. Look into that crystal ball and tell us, where do you think that relationship goes, given the new leadership of that country that is likely, as I said, to be around for 5 or 6 decades or more?
Well, traditionally, as Khalil pointed out, China has historically provided sustenance and economic aid and investment along with ideological support with this new latest hardline move by Pyongyang. China has been joining energetically with the rest of the United Nations in condemning North Korea. So I think North Korea will be increasingly isolated. They're the greatest mischief maker in the world, not just weapons and nuclear weapons, but conventional arms, small arms, drugs, bootleg liquor, counterfeit money, prostitution, you name it, they're into it. They're desperate for hard currency, and they're making trouble all over the world. Mm-hmm. The other side of that coin is
Tell us a little bit more about the drug. I've not heard that connectivity to them as relates to the drug trade.
I don't know in detail. They're very good at avoiding publicity, but authoritative U.S. Officials, especially in law enforcement, have been forthright in condemning North Korea for being involved in criminal illicit activities of all kinds, including drugs, prostitution, bootleg liquor, counterfeit currency, things well beyond the weapons trade.
When we come back, I want to find out more about not only the terrorism, but I also want to talk about what's going on with cyber attacks, with the huge story about about what China is up to, but if China is up to it, maybe North Korea will soon be up to it as well, if they're not already up to it. 1-800-723-8029, talking about foreign policy, the U.S. role in the world tonight. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Our professors are they're checking each other's politics out. They want to know, where are they, left
cars.
Wing?
We were talking right cars, wing? Too.
Well, I
Bruce.
Know we're talking cars, and you're you had a car. You had 413,000 miles on your car.
Yes.
What was it about that? You just didn't want to go to 415,000. What was it that made you say, "I'm going to get rid of this 1999 Dodge Avenger"?
Yeah.
Avenger.
Right. I came back from visiting Mr. and Mrs. Clausen in San Francisco in January. We were discussing off the air, and late at night when I got home from O'Hare, the car just wasn't starting, and there were all kinds of things. The car was indicating to me that it was time, and I finally started listening. I'm on the road a lot for good old Carthage College, including in rural areas and bad weather.
We're still
and,
working.
You know, I want to be frugal, Bruce, but I don't want to be stupid.
413,000 miles. No. That's I'm very impressed with that.
That's not bad.
What I want to talk, we're talking about foreign policy this evening, and again, in hour number one, you've touched on you know, on Turkey and the relationship between Turkey and Israel, and the fact that the president was able to get Netanyahu to pick up the phone and sort of apologize for the attack that took place last year, or actually a couple of years ago. My question to you is, and I've asked this question before sort of rhetorically when we've had other guests on the program, and that is Turkey. I am fascinated by Turkey, and one of the things that fascinates me is that for the most part, not always, for the most part, they tend to be supportive of what we as a nation are doing. Mm-hmm. And yet they have their own independence, and they don't always help us. I think when the Iraq War started, they didn't give us the help initially in that war, which I know maybe turned a lot of people off towards Turkey. But again, they are an independent and sovereign nation. What is it, in your view, I'm going to start this with you, Art, what is it about Turkey that makes it so unique and so strategically important to the United States?
They're 85% plus Islamic. At the same time, they have a strictly secular constitution. And the constitution overall, even though they have a fundamentalist religious party now in government, with the same kind of complaints and denunciation of Israel from some leaders that we were discussing before, they remain strictly secular and very much looking to the West. The cliche is there are crossroads between East and West. They control the Strait of Bosporus and major access routes to the Mediterranean both ways. They did not support our invasion of Iraq and refused to let U.S. armor go through the country, but most of our allies did not support us, except for the British and one or two others. They were worried in particular about the Kurdish minority becoming more fractious and dangerous if we smashed up Iraq. In the first Gulf War, by contrast, they permitted us to base B-52 bombers, which did the vast mass of destruction against the Iraqi ground forces on their territory. It was a real risk. I'm a great supporter of South Korea, our most important ally in Asia and one of our most important in the world. I visited the Pusan UN Cemetery in 1985 or 87, and outside of U.S. and South Korean graves, the Turks have an enormously large number of graves, underscoring their commitment to the U.S.
Yes,
very similar to the South Koreans' commitment to the U.S. So they're really good allies of ours, dating back to the beginning of the Cold War.
What is unique about them, though? Because, again, we talked in the first hour about how we have spent our foreign aid. We've spent it with the goal of buying friends in the world. How much money has Turkey received?
I don't think they're a principal interest of
they're
U.S.
Not,
foreign aid.
Sorry, okay, it's not. So again, what's unique? Can Lil, you want to weigh in on that? What is so unique about the Turks and the Turkish government? If they're not doing it just because we've given them billions of dollars, as may have been the case with Egypt and certainly with Pakistan.
Absolutely.
Why are they so unique? Why do they stand out?
Well, because Turkey is kind of like a hydra. It's a little bit of something to everybody. So, for example, Turkey is an aspiring member of the European Union, even though the Europeans, to their detriment, by the way, have rejected their membership, especially France. Turkey is a member of NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, right. That has assisted and really been at the forefront of American policy, not just in that part of the world, but as we saw recently in North Africa with the toppling of Gaddafi. Turkey is best friends with everybody, right? So even though the United States does not have relations with Iran, formal relations, Turkey actually has a thriving relationship with Tehran. The Erdogan government, as my colleague Art Sear points out, is both Islamist and yet at the same time is a model of what Islamist governments can be to America. Turkey is, I wouldn't say it's fully democratic. I mean, it's a very minimal definition of democracy that I'm employing, but it's fairly democratic. You know, the Turkish generals have gone back to their barracks. They allow the civilian government to rule. Turkey is a model of what an Islamic country can be, with a large, substantial majority of the 75 million people in Turkey being Muslim. You basically have a democracy, an ally of the West, and really, you know, we talk about crystal balls, a fairly sort of, you know, moderate regime in the midst of a region that has a lot of extremisms and a friend to everybody, especially the United States of America.
But they also have, again, their prime minister rankled a lot of people when he said mm-hmm. that Zionism yeah. was, quote, a crime against humanity, mm-hmm. end of quote, mm-hmm. which is a description that particularly rankled some Jews because that's generally the term used when you're talking about the Holocaust.
Of course.
So again, is he doing it because he believes it, or is he doing it because he has 85% of his constituency that he thinks may agree that? And do you think they do believe that?
You know, I think it's both. And yet he governs over a country that is compulsory secular. So it's not so much that
What does that mean?
Meaning that for example, in Turkey, you have. Bans on the veil, for instance, right? Until very recently, Turkish women were not allowed to even veil, right? So, and this is really something that goes back to Ataturk and really goes back to an attempt to make the country modern and secular and industrial and so on and so forth, right? So when you have people like the prime minister or the foreign minister or the president or whoever it is talking about Israel or Zionism in a negative way, all of that was within a context where the Israelis and the Turks engaged in hostilities, right? I mean, the Israeli commandos attacked a Turkish ship that was bound for Gaza and killed Turkish nationals. So the Turkish government had to say something to placate a domestic audience. But I don't think anybody in Turkey thought that they went far enough. I think that most people in Turkey
now, were they, though, at that particular moment? Again,
yeah.
there seems to be some... The Turks have said that was a humanitarian mission.
Correct.
And the Israeli commandos fired on a humanitarian mission.
That's right.
The Israelis' description of that was that if these were peace lovers, that fought back and looked like they were ready to fight.
Correct.
Back.
Correct.
So
yeah.
who do we believe in that?
You know, at the risk of replaying the whole flotilla affair, I will say that you basically had the Israelis exercising their right to basically board a ship, but you also had, Turks, and it was a multinational ship, by the way. For example, one American was killed on there as well. You also had the Turks exercising their freedom of expression, but more importantly, their desire to send humanitarian aid to Gaza. I mean, there was not arms on the ship. It wasn't an armed ship. It came in peace towards the people of Gaza. The Israelis didn't see it that way because they saw it as an infringement on their sovereignty.
Is there any sign, Art, because this goes back a long, long way, this relationship. I know once upon a time there were missiles that were Turkish
That's
missiles
right.
during the Kennedy administration,
right.
when the Russians wanted them taken out of Turkey, and that was allegedly part of a trade to get missiles out of Cuba.
We know for sure that it was. The record is now clear. McGeorge Bundy, President Kennedy's national security advisor, in a very important book, a history book, not a kiss and tell book, Danger and Survival, Choices About the Bomb During the Nuclear Age, and came out in 1989. He put on the record for the first time that President Kennedy publicly rejected the Soviet demand for a trade of Turkish and Cuban missiles and privately accepted it. Mm. In fact, sent his brother to see Dobrynin, the Soviet ambassador, mm-hmm. and assured him emphatically, because we were getting right up to the edge of war, that if they would please take their missiles out after a decent interval, ours would be gone from Turkey.
Do you see any sign in Turkey that this 5-6 decade long relationship and being one of our best friends, again, not always, but mm-hmm. being certainly a reliable ally of the United States, do you see because of this the growing, even though the Constitution says that it must be a secular government, do you see the other pressures that are coming from the emerging, obviously very strong 85% Muslim nation? Mm-hmm. Do you see that that strength and that relationship wavering in any way in the future?
Well, I don't pretend to predict the future. So far, with our withdrawal from Iraq, I think things are improving. The generals have stayed in their barracks, which is important, in great contrast to us, in the Constitution. At Ataturk's direct insistence, the military has the right to intervene when the government is becoming too religious, too extreme, or in any other way violating the Constitution. And they did intervene every 20 years ago in 1960 when they hanged a lot of people who'd been running the government. Mm-hmm. In 1980, they didn't kill anybody, but they overthrew the government. They have tolerated this religious government. Now, they snub each other. It's almost like Washington games. They snub each other. The generals have avoided, at times, contact with the government, but they haven't intervened, which is the really important test. Turkey is also, I agree with Khalil about the Euro snobs, especially the French. To some extent, it's racism, I believe.
Yep.
Also, real fear. Turkey will dwarf Germany in terms of population if they enter the Union. But the Turks,
by the
more
way,
and more
we're
involved
we're
elsewhere.
Pause. I want to talk more about that, about some of the demographics, and also give Khalil an opportunity to respond as well. 1-800-723-8289. We're talking Turkey tonight on the Beltway.
On to Thanksgiving.
Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Around the table this evening, we have Khalil Morares here. He is an assistant professor working in a variety of colleges and universities in the area, most recently DePaul University. He's author of the book, The Arab Lobby, U.S. and Foreign Policy. And also joining us, he is a Palestinian, by the way. He was born in Kuwait, came to the United States in 1987, became a citizen in 2004, and Art Sear joins us, the pride of Hollywood High in Hollywood, California, UCLA.
That was a while ago, Bruce.
It was a while, but I remember you. You know, you're a UCLA, you're a California guy.
Golden age of Hollywood.
And also, did you go to high school with anyone that became famous?
Yes, Swoozie Kurtz.
I don't know.
Swoozie Kurtz?
She's
been a big name on Broadway in serious plays and a couple of TV series.
Oh.
And a couple of Playmates of the Month, if I can say that.
Oh,
on
really?
The air.
Yes. Which months were they?
Viewed from a distance many years ago. Back,
also,
back when Hugh Hefner was young.
Yeah. Oh, wow, that is a
few years.
They
were quite celebrities on them.
Art Sear is the A.W. Clawson Professor at at Carthage College in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Has been there for almost 15 years now and has been a regular guest on this program, I think, probably for longer
since
than
15. Since the golden age of Hollywood.
Longer than you were at Carthage College, because
yes,
we worked together when you were at the Chicago Council
Absolutely.
On Foreign Relations. We have lots of callers on the line. We're going to take one right now. Let's go to Youngstown, Ohio, where Jimmy is listening to us on WKBN. And again, I should congratulate everybody in Ohio. Ohio State with a real tough one, real tight one today.
It's tight.
Took it to the buzzer. Go ahead, Jimmy.
Yes, very. Thank you very much for that nice compliment about Ohio. You got a very interesting guest, and I'd like to chime in regarding our president's trip to Palestine and Jordan. Hmm. And to say the least, I'm very disappointed about. I voted for the man, for the president, but he did not. He lost his courage to the political pressure in Washington and to speak against the total freeze on the settlements in Palestine. because if we don't take a stand, and I believe that we should have our foreign aid be contingent upon whether our ally is going to listen to us or do they want to just suck our money as taxpayers' money and then give us the fingers, whether it's Egypt, Israel, or Jordan.
Yes.
Since Israel is receiving the majority of America's taxpayers' money, I found it unbelievable that the West is trying to expecting the Mideastern countries to believe us anymore, because I really believe we have lost our credibility as a peace broker. As long as hypocrisy and money and law run in Washington, D.C., we cannot ever accomplish a peace treaty. As long as we don't tell our allies, whether they're the Jews or the Palestinians or the Jordanians, if you don't do what we feel is peaceful and good for both countries, our aid is going to stop. Because I found it unbelievable that congressmen and senators are arguing like cats and dogs over cliffs, over sequestration, over Social Security, Medicaid, and yet that's the interest of America. They shouldn't even be arguing about it. They should immediately agree with the best interest of the American people.
Jimmy, let me ask you this question.
Yes.
If you're saying, again, we did talk about this, you know, in the first hour about when U.S. tax dollars go to a foreign nation through foreign aid,
mm-hmm.
are we really buying their friendship? And I think everybody agreed that that's really what we're doing. But my question to you is, let me just finish my point.
Go ahead.
If you're buying somebody's friendship and they are your friend, you even said just a few moments ago, you know, they have to act not only in the best interest of the United States, but also the interest of their own nation as well. You acknowledge that. So my question to you is, if there's a nation that agrees with you 95% of the time, do you still consider them a friend?
Hmm. So long as they are not harming the interests of their neighbors, so long as they are, say, for example, American administration, every administration that had taken place, publicly and privately, denounced the additional annexation of Palestinian land. But what the leaders who were born in the Bronx and came from Europe are telling America? Hell no. But we want your billions of dollars. We want your F-16s. We want your Bradley tanks. And that's the power that they have. Power causes arrogance. And as long as we don't take a stand with the Jews or the Jordanians, or don't matter what ally we have, we will continue like a dog chasing his own tail. Because, you know, hypocrisy just doesn't work in any country. Because dealing with, I think one of your guests, Mr. Khalil, said that indeed America has been given the greedy, not the needy. And I don't mind helping someone who wants to help themselves, but not to encourage them. On the one hand, I want you to make peace with your neighbor, but you know what? I'll give you any arms or anything you want.
All right, let's let both of our guests respond. You've made a good point. Let's let each of them respond. Khalil first.
Well, I mean, okay. To start with what Jimmy said, I mean, I think we should absolutely condition foreign aid to our interests. I don't think it should be a blank check. And I think that if our allies are doing something to spite us, then we really should basically say, look, you know, the money stops until you folks start doing X, Y, and Z in our interests. I mean, this is our money.
So we should pull the chain. We've got to be able to pull the chain.
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely. And we have to remember, Bruce.
Did we pull the chain of Turkey? I don't know how much money we give to Turkey. But again, when Turkey did not let us use their airspace to launch the war in Iraq. And our fighters had to fly around the country to their target.
That's right.
Did we pull their chain? Did we take any foreign policy, any aid away from them?
Not publicly. And the reason for that is because, publicly, you know, a lot of our aid is not going, most of our aid is going to countries that are further to the west, not so much in Turkey, right? So the question is, you know, what kind of leverage do we have with Turkey? I think that we need Turkey as much as they need us and vice versa, right? It's a mutual relationship. But at the same time, Turkey did stand up to us in the Iraq War, and probably because, you know, they understood that the Iraq War was a mistake. And actually, that's something that most Americans are coming around
to
seeing.
They also just had a change in their own government.
And they did have a change in their own government. And here's the thing, you know, friends will tell you not what you want to hear. Real friends will tell you basically what they think, and what they think usually is in the interests of yourself. And that's what Turkey was trying to do in the Iraq War.
Art, a word for Jimmy. Any comment for Jimmy?
Well, all I wanted to say is I think the Jews deserve to live peacefully like everyone else. But at the same time, as an American first, I think I'll be damned if I'm going to stand still and don't speak against what is wrong. Because if Zionism means taking the entire world, someone should speak against it. Because when your congressmen and senators, the moment they see anything that's going to affect Israel, they don't argue about it. But they've been arguing for the past how many years since Obama has taken place over the taxes, over cliffs, over what absolutely things that means a lot they shouldn't even be arguing about. So something is wrong in Washington. As long as we're bowing down to the power of money, we will be worshipers of money instead of the man we call him God. Shame on us if we don't do anything about it.
Jimmy, listen, thanks very much for your call. We do appreciate your passion and your call. Let's go to Bonnie listening to us on WLS Radio in Chicago, our flagship station. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call. I have a question for Camille. From a purely practical perspective, not thinking about what promises were made and how people have been treated and such, okay, let's say that in the future, Palestine gets its own state. So you have Israel, you have Palestinian state next to there. Now, considering that Palestinian people don't have particularly a great love for Israelis, and considering that they're not militarily very strong, what is to stop a country like Iran or Syria from just basically walking right into the Palestinian state, saying, we're in charge now, and then lobbing missiles at Israel? And, you know, I'm just saying sort of the opposite point of view that, I mean, wouldn't Israel be kind of crazy to agree to a, you know, a division like that?
You know, that's a great question, Bonnie, and the answer is two words, self-interest. The Palestinians would not be interested in a foreign power coming in and using their territory as a tool to lob missiles against Israel. And if we want to talk about missiles,
what if they gave them money?
Well, the Iranians are giving money, for example, to Hamas until very recently when Hamas stood up to the Syrian regime, the Assad regime, and said, stop slaughtering your people.
What if they gave them more money? What if North Korea gave them money? What if other nations gave them money?
You know, they're not.
What if they walked right in?
Yeah, they're not. The Palestinians are not for sale. And actually, the truth is, the more that you have instability and the more that you have fanaticism in the Palestinian territories, the more likely they are to side against our allies. And it's been empirically demonstrated that any time that we've talked about a two-state solution for the Palestinians and the Israelis, not only do you have agreement, overwhelming consensus from the Quartet, from the EU, from Russia, from the United States, from Israel, from the Palestinians themselves. I mean, we're talking here about a solution that actually has over 70% support in Israel, a two-state solution that has the support of everyone in Congress, a two-state solution that has the support of President Obama. That is a solution for moderation, Bonnie. It's not a solution for extremism. And the truth is, if we have that kind of solution, we will have internationally mandated, internationally respected boundaries that basically deter any one enemy from attacking anyone. And the truth is, if you look at the power balance, Israel has all the cards. Israel is capable of destroying the Palestinian territories, not the other way around.
Well, again, when we come back, I want to challenge you on one point, sure, that the Palestinians are not for sale. If every nation in the world is potentially for sale, why would the Palestinians be different? Back shortly in the Chicago Times. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and before the break, Khalil, you had said something that caught my ear, and I couldn't quite believe it. You said when Bonnie was suggesting that if there was a Palestinian state, there could be an outside source. Maybe it's Iran. Maybe it's someplace else. They could come in. They could bring in their power and their influence, and they could set up maybe a military situation in the Palestine that would make it easier for them to attack Israel.
Yeah.
And you said, well, you know, the Palestinians, you know,
are not for sale.
Are not for sale.
Yeah.
No. Why would they not be for sale? I mean, look at all of the nations we talked about tonight that at some point they have, you know, they were for sale.
Yeah.
Why couldn't they be for sale?
That's a great question. The Palestinian people are not for sale. Their government is rotten. I mean, the Palestinian Authority is rotten and has repeatedly basically sold itself to the highest bidder. But at the same time, if you look at the Palestinian Authority, they have not – we don't see missiles raining down on Israel from the West Bank, where the Palestinian Authority is, which is a much more corruptible entity, government entity. The Palestinian people, on the other hand, are not for sale insofar as they basically want a couple of things. One, they want to end the Israeli occupation. They don't want Israel ruling them with military force. And two, they want to be able to tend to their lives, their livelihood, their lands, their farmlands, and so on and so forth. You know, Bruce, this is a land of incredible beauty and incredible resources. And if the Palestinians are allowed to basically live on that land, I think they would thrive not just as an ally of the United States of America, but ultimately the best ally, the best friend that Israel has is the Palestinians. They're not interested in regional players as much as they're interested in basically ending the military rule that they have over them. When I say they're not for sale, I'm not saying that, you know, that they're not corruptible. Their government is very corrupt. What I'm saying, however, is that the people of the Palestine will not stand for any foreign power dictating the terms to them. That's what I mean by they're not for sale, where you have the highest bidder coming in and lobbing missiles at Israel because it's going to end their existence as a national community.
Do you agree with that? Would they not be susceptible to persuasion and influence by an outside military and powerful force if that country could be used, again, especially if they're propping up and making life better for the average Palestinian on the street? Why wouldn't they sell out because it would seem to me that you have this lifetime of festering hatred for the Israelis. They've occupied the area. The hatred is really there. It's going to be there for generations. Why wouldn't an outside force come in with some money and influence and say, hey, listen, let's keep jacking these people up and let them let's use their land and let's destroy Israel once and for all?
Right.
The question, why wouldn't they do that?
Right.
To answer your question, the questioner asked about another nation taking over. There actually have been very few examples of one nation overtly of invading another since the Second World War.
That's right.
That's the good news, and was one of the beneficial byproducts of the Cold War. So it, in fact, has been pretty unusual. Nationalism,
How about putting up like we talked about, you know, when we had our missiles in Turkey. In other words,
that was during the Cold War.
It was, but again, conceptually, couldn't the same thing work?
I don't think so, because our missiles in Turkey were part of the status quo. I think to some extent it's comparing apples and oranges. You don't have the military stakes and ideological stakes of that earlier period. And again, it's unusual for one nation to invade another. It's why Iraq's invasion of Kuwait was so significant.
Let's go to Carlos listening to us tonight on XM Satellite Radio, calling from Houston. Go ahead, Carlos.
Thank you, sir. The question was asked what a nation I fear. The House of Saudi Arabia more than these other nations, because it seems like since Jimmy Carter days, they've been buying off our presidents, congressmen, and senators on how we should react in the Middle East, and I fear that greatly. Second thing, as far as Israel is concerned, hey, I love America, but I'm going to tell you something. If we turn our back on Israel, I'm standing with Israel. That's all there is to it.
Well, it's sure unlikely that we're going to be turning our backs on Israel.
That's right.
So you probably.
What about his point about
Saudi
Arabia? That Saudi Arabia may be the most fearful of all nations insofar as the power and influence, and that they buy politicians right and left.
I agree. They seem very fearful. Henry Kissinger used to say, when he was in power, that you know they're not really a country; they're a very rich family surrounded by a lot of sand.
Mm-hmm.
They're extraordinarily anxious, and they're extraordinarily anxious to pay off anybody who they feel threatens them. They've been quite ruthless in pursuing their own. They've been quite greedy in pursuing their own expansion of wealth. But that really came to an end with the end of OPEC as a monopolist in the 1980s. I think that it's important for strategic reasons to keep them on our side. But they don't seem as dangerous as other countries in that very volatile, very dangerous region.
What about the people? Are there people likely to rise up against them as they have been in other parts of the world?
That doesn't seem likely. They are a major supplier of terrorist groups.
Yes.
I mean, it wasn't Afghans or Iraqis or even Iranians. The 9/11 terrorists were to a significant degree Saudi in origin.
Mm-hmm.
And terrorist Robert Pape, whom you've had on your program, and I look forward to you having him again,
mm-hmm.
one of the few people who has actually analyzed the phenomenon, emphasizes that they tend to be well-educated, prosperous professionals, suicide bombers, many of them female.
And look, I mean, I think to say that the Saudis have undue influence on American governance is just completely like, it's just a bizarre comment, and I'm not even going to address it. I will say this, though. I will say that if the Saudis had their way, we would have had the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002 already in place. We would have a Palestinian state. The truth is they don't have their way, and there are people that have actually argued quite the contrary, that instead of the Arab lobby, instead of the Saudi lobby actually having any influence in the United States of America, it's actually quite the opposite. It's actually the Israel lobby that has all kinds of influence. Now, I wrote a book that actually completely and wholeheartedly and really ultimately vigorously basically opposes and rejects that point of view. But it's really not wise to say that one country, whether it's Saudi Arabia or Israel, has total domination over American governance. I think that's really the kind of stuff that anti-Semites are known for saying, and it sounds like David Duke-ish, except instead of anti-Semite in terms of anti-Jewish, it's anti-Semite in terms of anti-Arab. They're both Semites.
Okay. Matt, no, we don't know the caller. I'm not certainly casting
the position.
The position is not
the caller at all.
But
absolutely.
We thank you for your call. This program is a Gen B production produced in association with WLS Talk Radio in Chicago. Our thanks to Tom Vera Cruz and Dan Dorfman for their assistance in the production of this program tonight, featuring Art Sear and Khalil Morar. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.